Hello everyone, it is another Saturday with Shaggin' Flies. I've got a special one coming at you this week, an actually special one because, unfortunately, Ben Palmer could not be with us this time. He woke up on Tuesday morning and was just transformed into a giant dill pickle spear, so he's okay, to be clear, but thanks to that, I went solo this week with Howard Megdal, who is a veteran of many different sports media scenes, but in recent years has been pioneering coverage of women's sports with his newsrooms such as The Nine and The Next, which cover women's sports in the WNBA extensively. He currently resides at Baseball Prospectus as well. He'll be publishing an updated edition of his book this upcoming spring, The Baseball Talmud. We talked about all of those things, and also about how we're probably the only two alumni of Bard College, the weird and wonderful school that we both attended, to ever meet on a baseball podcast, because, to say the least, Bard is not known for its athletic prowess. So you'll have to indulge some of that conversation in between the WNBA and MLB talk, but we do get to a lot of baseball, so sit back, relax, and strap it down for episode 26 of Shaggin' Flies with Howard Megdal.
That said, yeah, I'm good. Listen, our Raptors and men's basketball are 2-0. We're going to go beat the hell out of Sarah Lawrence tonight in women's basketball, and very exciting times in the Bard Athletics Department.
Yes, yes, it certainly is. I have plenty to talk about with Bard in a little bit, but before we get into that, I'm just curious. Mm-hmm. This is how we usually start things off. Just where are you at right now, and where are you from?
I am currently in Rivervale, New Jersey, which is where mm-hmm. I live. I grew up in Jersey, too, in Cherry Hill, which is closer to Philadelphia. Now I'm a little closer to New York, and I work from home for the work I do when I'm not out covering something, and I'm here with my family, my two daughters and my wife.
Mm-hmm. So awesome. Yeah. One of the reasons we are talking now is that you are a baseball person. You write for Baseball Prospectus among mm-hmm. many other places, which we will talk about. But so I'm curious, how did you get into writing? I know I've been told that you did a lot of kind of self-starting stuff at Bard, from sports writing to onion type writing. So just tell me a little about your career and how you got to where you are.
It's an interesting question. It's hard to answer. You know, in one straightforward way, it's always been something that I've been passionate about. Journalism in middle school and high school newspapers. When we got to Bard, the Bard newspaper at the time was functioning in what I would say is sort of a traditionally Bard kind of way, which is to say it would come out every so often, possibly. And so wanted to change that. So created a newspaper of my own called The Outside World there, which was news, politics, sports, and, you know, a fair bit of satire as well. But when I got out of school, I took a job in politics because I thought I wanted to work for political campaigns. And I found I absolutely did not. I absolutely hated it. And so I was trying to regroup and trying to figure it out. And there was a newspaper not far from where we went to school called the Hudson Register Star, and an opening for a news and a sports reporter, a hybrid. And I took it, and I just loved it. And it was sort of a further reminder that whatever else I wanted to do, journalism was going to be pretty central to it. And I've done a lot since, I know we'll get into, but that's kind of been at the center of it for me.
Man, that's so familiar. I did basically the same thing. As I got out of Bard and I took I wasn't sure, you know, what I wanted to do. I'm still to some extent not. This wasn't all that long ago, and I took a job with a political consultant. Right. I'm based here in Chicago, and okay. it was supposed to be this real, you know, golden stepping stone type job, very, you know, progressive politics and all that stuff. And I got into it and I immediately realized, like, oh God, this is horrible. This is not, I don't have, you have to have a certain type of personality to work in politics, especially kind of high stakes politics. And I guess all politics are high stakes, but that's a different conversation. But
we just found that out with all the school board elections.
Exactly. Or I should say, like, the glamorous politics, you know, citywide and big elections and what all the ambitious young kids dream of. But no, it's horrible. You know, you have to have a certain kind of cutthroat personality sometimes. And I very quickly figured out that wasn't me. I was not really cut out for that, and I didn't want to do that. So as is the case for many early 20 somethings who have no idea what they want to do, I went back to grad school. And I realized in the summer between when I quit that job and went back to grad school, I was in recovery from thyroid cancer and had a few procedures for that. And I just kind of started writing and sending stuff places, as you know, I had a lot of time on my hands, and it's like, why not? And very quickly realized, like, oh, this is something I like. This is something I want to do. I still don't know what I still to this day don't know exactly what I want to do, but I'm fairly certain that writing is going to be central to it. So yeah, that's a very relatable path. So.
It does. Figuring out how to make writing central to the way we make a living in 2021 is its own set of complicated questions. But you know, so figuring out what you want to do is overrated anyway. I'm 41. I would say I have a fairly decent idea of much of what I want to do, but I wouldn't say I necessarily figured out the precise shape of how it's all going to go from now until whenever I decide to stop.
And your body of work is pretty impressive, and I must say, so that says something. So tell me a little bit, before we get into Bard, to stick with the writing, about the next, the nine, and how you got into women's sports and founding all of these excellent publications, which I recommend everybody check out. And tell me how you got into that scene and how that developed.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, from the time I was at the Register Star on, from the very beginning of my sports writing, I was covering.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but my cat has caught a mouse and has just brought it into my room.
Oh, okay.
You're gonna. Sorry, let me. Sure, let me
that's...
Okay? I think it's dead, so I can just run and toss it out real quick.
Sure, do you, by all means.
Silver, you are no. Hey, drop it. Is it dead? Yes, it's pretty dead. Okay.
He's efficient.
She's. Oh my God. Okay. Be right back.
Hey, Alex Fast here, and thanks for listening to this podcast on the Pitcher List Podcast Network. If you're a fan, consider supporting all of us by getting a PL Plus subscription, where you're going to get an ad-free website and get access to our Discord, where you can talk to all of our podcast hosts and staff. Plus, you can hang out with our incredible Pitcher List community. It's basically a baseball sanctuary year-round for as low as $8 a month. You can sign up at pitcherlist.com/plus, and you're going to get your first month free with promo code podcast. Also, don't forget to check out everything else we do as well, from YouTube videos, live streams, newsletters, off-season articles, TikToks, breakdowns, over 15 baseball podcasts on our network. We can't stop talking about baseball even during the off-season. So sign up for PL Plus today at pitcherlist.com/plus and use promo code podcast to get your first month free. All right, thanks for listening. Let's get back to the show.
Isn't that the Zoom work from home life, huh?
It is. I mean, look, honestly, there's not a podcast I've done where we haven't had a dead mouse in the middle of it. So I get it.
Totally normal. Totally run of the mill. So I'm sorry. I just asked you about the next and the nine and getting into women's sports and all that. So continue.
For sure. And so, you know, for me, from the very beginning, it was covering men's and women's, it was covering boys and girls when you were in high school. And then immediately there's this gap in coverage, and you feel it and you understand it. And at a certain point in my career, I got to a point where it wasn't simply a question of, this is something I'm going to try and fix on the margins, but I think I can really dedicate myself to changing the nature of the way this coverage happens. And so I did that for a while through trying to freelance it in many different places as possible, and trying to get those publications to change by giving them more of an opportunity to cover. Ultimately, I got to the point where that felt in many ways like I was kind of building in sand. And, you know, you're trying to figure out, all right, how do you at the infrastructure level try and change this? And so the Nine, which we began in 2018 and have grown significantly, is across six women's sports every single day. And, you know, why do we do that? Number one, because when it comes to making sure that you're empowering voices to do this, there need to be regular places where they have the opportunity to grow and grow their own audiences and be able to talk about it. We also do it because we have in each of the six, and it's women's soccer, tennis, basketball, golf, hockey, and gymnastics, we have a Lynch section. Why does that matter? That matters because you need to be able to have women's sports fans find the work. You know, if you are a person endeavoring to cover women's sports at a particular publication, you go to your editor is going to say, well, the last one didn't do so well, so maybe we don't want to do this one. And so making sure that the audience for that is as wide as possible is important, but also, why didn't it do so well? Well, if your editor allows you to cover women's sports once every 2 months and your audience isn't expecting it, then you haven't built the habit. And then it becomes a self-perpetuating thing. So making sure that our audience is doing that. If you care about women's tennis in one, you care about women's tennis in another publication, the audience comes together. And then the third part of it is ending that siloing effect. There are women's basketball fans who care about women's soccer. There are women's tennis fans who care about women's golf, but they don't necessarily know where to get that information. And our open rates are consistently above 40%, which is unheard of in the entire industry. And it's because people care about one, they care about the other. And so that's the Nine. And then the next is very simply a 24/7 women's basketball newsroom. And we have 30 journalists who are writing about the sport year round. So we're putting a lie to that myth that women's basketball is not year round. Women's basketball, as anyone who pays the slightest bit of attention will tell you, is the most year round there is. The moment that the WNBA finals ended, I had a day, and then I was off to Big East Media Day to go talk to UConn and Villanova and Seton Hall women's basketball players. There is no off season in women's basketball, even more so than anywhere else, before you even get into EuroLeague, before you even get into Athletes Unlimited, which is starting this year. And so showing that this is a year-round endeavor, it matters. We're showing the audience is consistent. I've been incredibly gratified by the amount of subscriptions we've had just in the year we've been independent at the next. It is simply building that infrastructure for an audience that's underserved.
Yeah, that's really fantastic work. Because I can tell you how if I had seen something like that growing up when I was, you know, in middle school and really in high school and really starting to dive into sports, then I absolutely would have been. I think I would have been a pretty diehard fan by now. I think yeah. I got there. I will say, hey, if you ever need any stringers for the Chicago Sky, hit me up. I recently bought season tickets for the Sky before this year, which talk about a great investment. this year, and it was honestly one of the most fun experiences I had had watching sports and being following a team, and being. Feeling like a part of a season in a million years. It helps that they won the finals, of course, but just the feeling of I started really following the league during the bubble last year, which is when I also came across the Nine. And so just the feeling, though, of being like kind of going through that process again of learning about the league, learning about the players, discovering the narratives and finding out the history was really, really, really fun. Because it's not something, I mean, I've been a White Sox fan for a million years. I've been a Bears fan. I didn't have a choice. I wish I wasn't, but you know, the Bulls are
a bad break.
Gosh, I don't even have to talk about it. You know, the Bulls are in my blood too, fortunately. So I really, really would love to think that if you can continue to grow this and you get more and more sources like that, and that you make it a consistent part of what people are seeing, I think a lot of other people are going to discover that too.
I mean, what is aggravating about it is that it is as simple as showing up and making it possible for people to show up. The everyday, and I emphasize this a lot on social media, but it's so central to it. There's nothing magical about the fact and the ways that men's sports are able to be fully engaged. They're able to be fully engaged because if you care about it, you're reading about it every day, you're able to consume it every day. During the season, you're able to consume, as I'm sure you know, as you know, from a baseball fan, an NBA fan, the off season is, if anything, even more significant in terms of how people are connected to it as well. And it's all right there. And if you don't give people the ability to do that, and by and large, sports media has not done that for women's sports. The fact that women's sports has grown as much as it has is almost a remarkable thing. You know, you hear these percentages, you know, like 4% of all coverage is women's sports. And even that number, honestly, may be overstating it. It depends on how you define it. It depends on how you measure it. It depends on, you know, old versus new media and all these different ways. Well, the attendance differences are not 4%. You know, the WNBA average attendance at its low ebb was about 45% of the average attendance of NBA. Well, so anybody worth a damn statistically is looking at that and saying, you've got something that's performing at 10 times the rate of the media coverage it's receiving. So first of all, the media coverage is woefully out of balance with the audience you're talking about. And second of all, what an opportunity if you were to equalize coverage. There's every reason to think the WNBA would do better than the NBA. And and so I view it in a lot of ways as women's sports is very much a developing economy and men's sports is a developing economy.
Yeah. I mean, I can only imagine the frustration because it was almost outrageous to me. I remember watching a couple weeks ago, I'm watching SportsCenter the night that the Sky clinched the finals. And this year's Sky were an incredibly fun team. Narratives up the wazoo. You know, there's really a lot to talk about, and there was a lot to have fun with. And then watching Scott Van Pelt on SportsCenter kind of stumble through, like clearly reading off a prompter. It's like he could tell me, he can have a conversation. He'll bring freaking OBJ's trainer's brother onto the show and have an in-depth conversation about what they're doing this week. And you can't even like get Kalia Copper's name right. Cut me a break.
the number of times that you see limitations on this because it isn't necessary to be versed in women's sports in order to get a general sports job. And I'm not talking about anyone in particular in this case. I'm saying throughout the industry, you can't get hired in these general sports jobs if you can't speak about the NBA and the NFL and Major League Baseball, right? But it isn't a prerequisite over and over again to be able to do it about the WNBA or the National Women's Soccer League or PHF. And the net result are decisions editorially that reflect that. And when somebody uncomfortably stretches, moments like that.
Yeah, and I wonder, especially as politics and sports become more and more intertwined, or not intertwined so much as sort of impossible to deny that intertwining, I wonder if that's going to be a factor in people being able to identify more with the WNBA and their players and kind of the way they operate a little more. Like, there's a lot of people who are like, it's hard to be a football fan. you know, Major League Baseball makes it really hard to be a baseball fan sometimes, a lot of the time.
I mean, you can go beyond politics, though, even to just as there's a rise in popularity, it gets harder and harder to ignore. Listen, I am a longtime soccer fan, and I remember when you absolutely did not have any chance of seeing soccer in most mainstream publications. It was perfectly acceptable to bash soccer, and that was the default position of much of the sports media industry. And that has changed over time. It became too popular to ignore. And ultimately, I believe the same thing can and is happening already with women's sports, but will continue. And, you know, who are you writing for, ultimately?
And yeah, I mean,
people who are sports fans.
And hopefully I hope it continues to become more and more accessible too. That was a huge, I mean, I know moving from until a couple of years ago, the Sky played all the way out in the northwest suburbs, like by O'Hare Airport. And it was, I'm like, it's far away. It's very far away from most people. And they moved a few years ago to a new arena, that was built, unfortunately, with Chicago's education budget, but, like, you know, again, whole other conversation. This is, sorry, Ben, this is what happens when you let me run the show. and it was, you know, it made a huge difference. It takes 10 minutes for me to get to a Sky game. That sort of casual accessibility. And I went to a Chicago Red Stars game this past summer, my first NWSL game, my first pro soccer game. I'm not a huge soccer guy. And I'm like, this is fun. I would, if this wasn't all the way out in the southwest suburbs where I have to either drive 45 minutes and pay for parking, I would do this all the time.
Sure. I mean, it's an absurd idea that everyone always talks about, you know, there are very specific women's reasons why women's sports struggle in a lot of these tropes that don't bear basic scrutiny. If you make it accessible, more people are going to show up. If you make it easier to get there, more people are going to show up. If you make the experience better, more people are going to keep coming back. We've got a team out here in Jersey that was called Sky Blue FC that used to play at Rutgers. And it was like the middle of nowhere in every conceivable way. Okay. If you think about the state of New Jersey, and those of the people listening who know Jersey understand it, New Brunswick's middle of the state. You're just far enough from New York and just far enough from Philadelphia that both markets are going to probably not pay attention to you. You're playing a season that's primarily in the summer. So all of your local college students have gone away for the most part. And it's a 5,000 seat soccer stadium with only benches and a single place to buy food and drink. When they moved from that arena, from that stadium, to playing at Red Bull Arena, which is the premier soccer place in the area, which is significantly closer to New York and thus also available, easily accessible by the PATH train, attendance was up over 30% this year. In year one, coming off a pandemic, if you look around, even very popular sports that did well, attendance was typically down. So you're doing that into the wind of people coming back from COVID. It's just, in the same way that, and it always aggravates me so much, the idea, you know, well, why aren't women supporting women's sports more? Well, same reason men haven't been, right? Because men's sports, people learn about it through media channels, through investment, through publicity, through promotion. Women's sports, if you put the same energy and the same money behind it, people are going to learn the same way. And women don't consume things differently. Men aren't getting this through traditional methods, and women have like a traveling pants of media information, right? It's the same damn thing, and it's at the same disadvantages. And if you level the playing field across media and investment, and then there's a gap, then I'm willing to talk to you about a limitation of women's sports, right? But until we see anything approaching equality, and by the way, every time we do, and forgive me for this soapbox, but every time we see something approaching equality, you don't just see audience equalized. you see it greater than the most watched soccer match in American history is the 2015 Women's World Cup final. And I just, okay, we got to go off on a brief tangent here.
Oh, this entire show is a tangent. Stay on the soapbox, man.
Fair enough. Why did that happen? Well, the World Cup, men's and women's, has always been ESPN, ESPN broadcast. Fox gets the rights to both. They got a show, and there was a popular question at that time. Geez, can Fox do a World Cup? Whatever, it's a stupid thing, but there were a lot of people talking about it. So Fox is going to go all out. They're going to show they can do it. Well, they bought it right after 2014. So what's your first chance to do it? The 2015 Women's World Cup. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the 2011 Women's World Cup didn't do all that well. The send-off game for the women's national team at Red Bull Arena drew, I think, 5,800 fans. I mean, it was not great. Mm-hmm. But what does Fox Sports do? Well, they say, we're going to treat this like a big-time event, which, of course, it is. But these only are signified as big-time events by the proper level of investment and attention. So they didn't just put on the matches. They had previews. They had a ton of secondary programming around it. They sent people to all their other branding opportunities. You had Alex Morgan on The Simpsons. You had Abby Wambach on American Idol. So by the time we got to the matches starting, people were paying attention. And so my favorite number isn't just the 26.2 million who watched the final. There was a Tuesday morning group game between Brazil and China that drew 1.2 million fans watching. Tuesday morning group game, Brazil and China. This is what happens when you put it on all the time. This is a matter of course for a full court press men's event. We see it with NBA Summer League, which was nothing 5 years ago. And now, if you would like to hear somebody from the WNBA curse, just send them an email that ESPN sends out that says, every single NBA Summer League game will be on the ESPN family of networks. And you compare that to the way ESPN is kind enough occasionally to broadcast some WNBA games, even though they're their partners. And again, so it just comes back to, if you promote it the same way, we got these Venn diagrams that dummies use, right? Hey, well, there's this group of people who watch men's or women's sports, and then we got this group over here, and they're only going to watch men's sports. Well, guess what? There's another group over here that's only going to watch women's sports. You don't know how big it is. It might be even bigger than the men's side. There's evidence to indicate that it is. Every time we equalize coverage, maybe we ought to pay attention to that group too. And maybe we don't invest in such a way that makes everybody think there's only men's or men's and women's.
Yeah, it really becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy where you say, because the product is great. There is zero doubt about that. The product is great. You have to imagine that the correlation between, you know, there's going to be a pretty strong correlation between exposure and coverage and popularity because the product is there. We could go on forever about just the criminality and injustice of the underfunding and under coverage of these leagues. But to go a little more positive, I'm just curious, what are some of your favorite things about covering women's sports and the W and all these things?
The idea, I've talked specifically to me, the idea that last year at this time I wasn't vaccinated. I wasn't feeling comfortable going inside a building with a lot of people. And I didn't cover in person a single women's college basketball game last year. And it killed me. I wasn't at the Final Four. I couldn't imagine it for the first time in many years. So just the fact that I saw a schedule that had 150 plus basketball games on the agenda today is so exciting to me. The fact that we're in the midst of, you know, I'm going to get live looks at players. For a year and a half, I've been relying on what people are telling me, you know, coaches and other people who are able to see. So, you know, just the sheer massiveness of it is amazing to me. I'm going to get my baseball prospectus column done this afternoon. I'm going to go pick up my younger daughter who is basketball obsessed. And at 5 p.m., we're going to sit in front of the television and we're going to watch South Carolina versus NC State. And when I do that, to go to your question about covering it, I've covered Dawn Staley for years. Being able to appreciate and understand this legend is a person who we're telling her stories in real time means everything. Aaliyah Boston, you know, a future doctor if she weren't so damn good at basketball, you know, and so unfortunately for the medical community, she's going to go be a big star in the WNBA. We get to watch her play against Alyssa Kunane from NC State. Diamond Johnson, pride of Philly, transferred from Rutgers, and she's playing in this game. Zia Cook. I mean, you just go up and down both rosters. But every day there's going to be stuff like this. And, you know, being having the chance to tell those stories means the world. And, you know, I don't know. I was just talking to somebody recently. I can't remember who it was, but I have said this before. We get thanked by women's basketball figures again and again. Thank you for doing this. We'll know we've reached a certain degree of growth within the game when we don't get thanked. I've covered many NBA games. I've never had LeBron James. Hey, listen, Howard, I just want to thank you for shining a light on men's basketball in this country. Never happened. You're going to have to get to that point.
Oh, God, I hope. But I wonder, you know, there's a lot of issues. And this is probably the last thing I'll say so we can expedite the rest of this a little bit. But hey, there's a lot of issues with the NCAA and the whole name and image and likeness deal. But you do wonder how much of an effect that's going to have when you have folks like, I mean, you remember the numbers last year on Paige Beckers and the Instagram thing, you know, like, I wonder how much of a difference that's going to make in terms of that exposure and getting people to know who these individuals are and sort of be able to follow them and their careers and develop that attachment that leads to, you know, sustainable fandom.
Well, yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. I talked to Paige about this a couple weeks ago. Yeah. And she was speaking about the fact that ultimately she wants to play basketball and the rest is going to take care of itself. Now, it's a little more complicated than that. She's got a rep. She's, you know, she's doing it the smart way. And she'll do very well. And Paige is, incidentally, a generational talent to everyone listening. Go Paige Beckers first chance you can. But, yeah, exactly. It helps. It makes a huge difference. But it also, when you look at the way the economics of being a women's basketball player have changed just in the last couple of years, you know, you got NIL, which allows you to cash in ahead of time, you know, because there is no one and done. You have to be 22, the year of the draft, if you are a domestic player. And then the new CBA has raised the floor of salaries in the WNBA significantly. And in a way that may not seem like much because you still say, my God, you know, why are they making $60,000, $70,000, $80,000? But the minimum, the rookie minimum was $41,300 before the new CBA. So it makes a difference. And you add those things together and suddenly you're not looking for the big payday overseas, which is, by the way, you know, only a handful of players every year who are able to get the big, big money overseas. It's going to matter. It has changed pretty dramatically what people are able to earn playing basketball, you know, within the women's basketball structure. And that's before you even get to Athletes Unlimited, which gives an opportunity to stay stateside and continue to do it.
Well, let's hope. I'm really excited to see where it goes in the next, over the next 5, 10, 15 years. And I could talk about this all day. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a long time. Before we get to baseball stuff, which we probably should do being on the Pitcher List podcast network, yes, and all that, let's talk for a second about Bard College. And I realize I didn't say this at the beginning of the pod, so their listeners might be a little bit confused. I'll talk about it in the introduction, whatever. But we are both alumni of good old Bard College, the Raptors in, yes, Annandale on Hudson, New York. I don't know. I don't want to say for sure that we are perhaps the only two sports media people, and I say that about myself very, very generously, to come out of Bard College. There may be others out there, but it is not a sports school. Let's put it that way. So I'm curious what kind of a drove you to Bard, being like, were you always thinking about sports? How did that dynamic work at a school like Bard, which even more so than when I was there, was not very athletically inclined?
Yeah, no, it's an excellent point. I've always loved sports. I've always loved literature, which is what I came to study. Creative writing was a concentration there for me. I had the amazing Ben Lafarge as my advisor. I was very grateful and learned so much from him. And Liz Frank, another wonderful professor, and so many. And Youth Rosenberg, who sadly we just lost.
He pass?
He did.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Ago, at age 100, who fought the Nazis as part of the resistance.
Quite the personality.
Just a wonderful man. Peter Sorian, who passed, and James Chase taught me political science as well. None of those things were reasons not to come to Bard, right? But yes, you get there. And so, you know, I got there in the fall of 1998. And, you know, the internet was in its infancy. There were a handful of websites even devoted to various college basketball teams. UNC had one and Duke had one. And so I made one devoted to Bard called Raptor Mania. And I got a real kick out of that, Ken Pomeroy was in his infancy and you could go to the Ken Pom D3 ratings and we were at the very bottom of D3. I would write angry emails, satirical angry emails to Ken Pom asking why he was biased against liberal arts schools. I got fairly dismissive responses, if I remember right, which is only and totally appropriate. I also have been someone who never minded rooting for the underdog. And so the fact that I was able to, at WXBC, I've got colleagues who went to Syracuse and there was this cutthroat battle to be the voice of Syracuse men's basketball. It was not a battle. get in line. You're willing? Okay, good. And I was the voice of Bard College basketball for 4 years. And, we didn't win a men's home game until my senior year. And even that game, from a Ken Pom perspective, it wasn't a big win. We beat Hampshire, but all the same, it was very exciting and a big moment. And I loved every minute of it. And I've been thrilled, the men's team to be able to go to Johnson State and win a couple of games this weekend. I love to see it. My friend Adam Turner was a coach there for a long time, and Adam really built that team. But to your point about it being a sports school or not being a sports school, Leon used to take pride in coming to the sports banquets and saying negative things about sports. Leon was another reason why I came to that school. I read Jefferson's Children when I was in high school and I thought, all right, I knew I did not enjoy my high school experience. I knew if I wanted to go to college, it was going to have to be something different. And I read Jefferson's Children and I thought, this man's college is going to be something different. And it was. And I'm thrilled I went to Bard, but it didn't have to be at the expense of sports. I think Leon has come to realize. I'm hopefully.
I can say, I don't know what it's like now. I graduated in 2018, but in terms of the Leon, this is Leon Botstein, listeners. Yeah. We won't bore you with the inside baseball of Bard College too much longer, but Leon Botstein is the president of Bard College. He is the kind of person that he does have a Wikipedia, and he would be described as a polymath, I guess you could say. Very interesting.
Very true.
Very quite the personality, and he still, in my time at Bard, I don't know if he took pleasure in it, but we could always come to expect him to show up at some sports related event and make everybody very vaguely uncomfortable with his very clear disdain for the entire operation. And you do bring up our friend Adam Turner, who I was going to leave anonymous for a little while as my source here. But I was told I need to ask you about a couple things in particular.
The first one is,
and I'm really, really curious what this could possibly be. What is your best Drag Race story?
Oh, Lord. What was always amazing about Bard was that I am liberal in so many different ways. But at the same time, the school was liberal in a different sort of way, by which I mean, you know, for instance, I was there during the fall of 2000. Mm-hmm. And I was very dedicated to hoping that Al Gore would be elected. And that made me, of course, you know, a conservative by Bard standards.
Yeah, that's how it goes.
You know, as a whole, they went for Ralph Nader. Mm-hmm. You know, we could have a whole different discussion as to whether that worked out for America or not.
Lord, we could.
But neither here nor there. So the point being, you know, unfortunately, I was more of a bystander. I never did dress up for Drag Race, you know, not out of any sort of personal objection, but in much the same way that, you know, I've become a progressive, you know, living a very suburban life with a wife and two children. But at the same time, you know, delighted that I was at a school where the Drag Race was such a big deal, where it was. It's the thing I love, I think, as much as anything about Bard, which is to say that there are so many ways in which Bard was welcoming in a way that I think was ahead of its time. And I think in a lot of ways, the country is still catching up to what it felt like to be on campus at the turn of the century.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I never got to do it or even watch it because it was always during baseball season.
Sure.
When I was always practicing or had a game. And the second thing before we get on to baseball, so I don't keep you forever, is Mike Mandlin. Explain this to me.
Michael Mandlin. I was just talking to him this morning. I mean, to this day. we battled to make Michael D3 Player of the Year in various outlets. And Michael was the backup center on the basketball team. It was a contemporary of mine, but
glamorous job.
But on a per minute basis, was as effective, as efficient as anyone in Division III. And so we were making a lot of sabermetric arguments that places like d3hoops.com and the like did not give the proper weight, in my opinion. But yes, Michael Mandlin, a wonderful fiction writer in his own right, one of the best humans. I'm looking forward to seeing him in the coming days. As a matter of fact, my girls are vaccinated now, yesterday, literally.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. It was a very big day for us.
Yeah.
Now we're going to start to have other vaccinated people into our home. And Michael is going to be the first of my friends. I'm really excited about that.
Yes, lovely.
One of Bard's best.
Lovely, lovely. Oh, man, could talk about Bard, all the good and bad all day. But we are here to some extent to talk about baseball. You do write for Baseball Prospectus. You are a Mets person from Jersey. Mike, do I have that right? You are, as are many. The central question around which this podcast is theoretically based is simply, why baseball? We've already talked plenty about women's sports and basketball and soccer. But you write about baseball. You could also write about football or men's basketball or men's soccer. But why baseball?
And I have for what it's worth. And well, I'm sure continue to at some level. And I will also say that I've written a fair amount. I have an upcoming piece coming about women's baseball as well. And let's not lose sight of the fact that women's baseball is growing tremendously. Is long overdue.
Great point.
More and more people come to understand that softball is a different sport than baseball, and that simply shunting every woman who likes to hit or pitch into a different sport is problematic for a host of different reasons. Mm-hmm. And someday when Justine Siegel is inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame, there will be a more popular understanding of that. And that's something I look forward to doing. And the reason I look forward to doing it is that as much as I love basketball, as much as I enjoy soccer, baseball is number one for me. And it has been for the longest time. And it is, I'll give you a different, it's more of an effect than a cause, but I think it comes back to answering your question. During the pandemic, we were extremely careful. You know, having two children, having a set of parents, two sets of parents, my wife's as well, who are in their 70s. And we didn't go anywhere. And we were housebound. We were trying to get through that period of time. And as much as anything else, what saved us emotionally, me specifically emotionally, was baseball. My daughter, my older daughter is 11. And was a casual baseball fan who became a passionate one. We were collecting cards together. We started doing card breaks together. It was something we do to this day. We want to help, as a matter of fact. My father is locked in his house, too. And we were playing Diamond Mine baseball together. We were able to play games against one another. You know, old teams. In the 1950s. It was a way in which to immerse yourself. And baseball offers you the opportunity to do that. And you know, from the life you've lived. When baseball is on, it is 162 games a year for Major League Baseball. There are 15 games a day, Major League Baseball alone. There are hundreds more in minor league baseball, even after the criminal pillaging of the minor leagues that we saw MLB perform last year. Tonight, there'll be basketball games for me to watch, but there will also be several Dominican Winter League games that I can turn to anyone. I can go back. I watched a lot of baseball this year, but there are thousands of games I've yet to get to that I can go back and watch and consume and see and understand in a new way players that I'm very curious about. There will be an endless array of conversations about off-season moves that teams may make. We are less than a month away from Hall of Fame votes for a host of people who belong in the Hall, including Gil Hodges, who I talked about on the very brick that I purchased in front of Citi Field in honor of my family, past, present, and future, that we go visit when we go to Mets games, and Dick Allen, who is, for a host of different reasons, underappreciated in his time.
Criminal.
And that conversation and all of those conversations, and they overlap and they work with one another. They're all part of what baseball is and was and can be. And I don't think there's anything else in my life that allows me to immerse so completely and emotionally and intellectually and in a way that obviously connects to my father, a Brooklyn Dodgers fan to this day, and my daughter, who I think will root for and will care about baseball after I'm gone. The way that this sport does. It means everything to me. And so it will always be central to the way in which I live my life.
Yeah, we've gotten similar answers to that before. It's just the constantness, the steady presence is so important. It's what makes baseball, it's just different in so many ways. And to stick with the vaccine talk, sometimes it feels like football and basketball are like a shot, you know, they're a big dose and they get you going. And baseball is like an IV. It's just a kind of steady drip and it's always there. And it's, you know, you don't notice it a lot of the time, but if you want to, you have it. And that's just so different. It's like, I don't really, and it's almost similar to the conversation about women's sports with some of the winter leagues and the minor leagues and stuff. I wish they had more exposure. I miss having random baseball games on in the middle of the day. Like put those on ESPN Plus or something, you know, put them on whatever channel and I will watch them and people will watch them.
A life hack I have for you is turn the scores off on your MLB.TV account. Click a day, click a game. You're not going to remember, you know, whether the Minnesota Twins won on May 28th or not. Mm-hmm. Click on it and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it reminds me one of my friends from grad school with whom I talk about the WNBA a lot. She got into the league. She's getting her PhD in American studies, which is what I have my master's in. And as she was studying for her field exams, which is one of those things where you have to read like, you know, freaking 100 books in a semester and be able to tell your hard ass professors about it and pass on to the next level. And she went through like every single WNBA game, damn near she watched every Chicago Sky game from the season before. And that's like exact same dynamic. That's how I'm going to do that. I'm gonna start doing that now. So I also want to give you a chance, to talk about your forthcoming book as well, which I'm, as a Jewish baseball fan, am super, super interested to hear about the baseball Talmud. So please, tell the listeners about that.
I mean, it's been such a fun experience over the past 6 months to put that together. Mm-hmm. You know, it was my first book. It was published in 2009. I wrote it over 2007 into 2008. Mm-hmm. And I had a joy doing it. But this was a different level. You compare research opportunities in 2007 and 2008 to what we have in 2021, it's just a different level altogether. Mm-hmm. And so I was able, before you even get into the fact, there've been a number of new Jewish players. This happened to be a very good season for Jewish baseball, right through the World Series.
Oh yeah.
Four Jewish players in the World Series. We were six short of a million.
I was really surprised when I saw, the news of was it Fried versus Bregman was the first Jewish pitcher versus hitter matchup in World Series history.
And it got better. And we had a Fried pitch that Bregman flew out to Jock Peterson.
Wow, I didn't even think about that. That's so great. That's perfect. I am really. I mean, I know there weren't too many, but I'm surprised that was the first time that it happened.
I was too, but you know, you go back and you look and. In terms of how many at any one time, and of course there was a long period of time where only two teams made the postseason. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that isolated things further, but ultimately it was exciting to see. It was, you know, and Max Fried winning game six was the first Jewish pitcher to win a game since Ken Holtzman in the 74 World Series, first Jewish pitcher to win a World Series game, mm-hmm. I should say, since Ken Holtzman in the 74 World Series. But yeah, I mean, it was telling those newer stories, but I was able to, you know, I was able to trace by going back to people's individual lives over at newspapers.com. Mm-hmm. I was able to see how they lived before, how they lived after, you know, guys at 17 years old when they got their big break, when they got the call, and guys, you know, decades after they had retired, the way they were living their lives. Mm-hmm. And so it was such a thrill. And I mean, I expanded it a ton, but I was also able to just tell full stories again and again. And so that was delightful. We come out in May of 2022. You can pre-order now. But oh man, there are just so many fun tidbits I was able to get to.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. And poor research on my part. I didn't realize that there was a previous edition that you'd already put out. So yeah, I think I know. I don't think my parents are listening to this. I know what I'm getting my dad for his birthday next year. So moving on with more baseball stuff. What is the coolest moment you've ever seen live? at a baseball game?
Oh God, what a great question. It might not even be something I covered, although I've had the privilege. I covered the best individual performance of any human in World Series history. So I covered David Ortiz during the 2013 World Series, working at Sports on Earth, may it rest in peace. And that was delightful. I got to cover a World Series game at Citi Field. I mean, be able to cover the World Series whom I grew up rooting for. It's an incredible thing. But I'm going to take you back to October 6th, 1991. I'm 11 years old. I had tickets to the final game of the Phillies versus Mets, Philadelphia Phillies Fan Appreciation Day. It was not a full house. Philadelphia by October was well into Eagles season. And at the stadium, you could hear the radios broadcasting Merrill Reese and the Eagles. But David Cone took the mound for the Mets, and he struck out 19 Phillies. And my dad and I got to watch it. Very few have ever done more. You know, Kerry Wood had 20. Roger Clemens had 20. But outside of that, David Cone, you know, tied what was then a National League record held by Tom Seaver. And I got to watch him strike out 19 Philadelphia Phillies on the final day of the 91 season. So that may well be the most incredible thing I saw. I would tie it with seeing Johan Santana in the penultimate day of the 2008 season, final weekend at Shea Stadium.
Oh, man.
125 pitches, three-hit shutout, kept the Mets in the playoff race for one more day and did it with a torn meniscus in his knee that required surgery. So those two might be there. Ronald Acuna Jr. hit a ball 463 feet as a rookie. I was doing a feature story there, so I was down for the game. I remember coming home and telling my wife, I was like, this guy's going to kill the Mets for the next 15 years. Be ready for it. And so he has.
And so he has. And so he looks like he will. Man, I definitely get that feeling that you're talking about. I feel like there's a kind of a different level between like really cool things that you see. And then there's moments where you walk out of the stadium and you're like, I'm never going to see that again. I know, like, I was fortunate enough to be present at Mark Burley's perfect game in 2009. And which has always been kind of a funny thing when I've been asked that question or had similar conversations, like, what's the coolest thing you've ever seen? Like, I'm never going to top that. That's and that's easily the coolest thing I've ever seen. And I will cherish it forever. And that's just like it's on a little bit of a different level. I can imagine that the 19 strikeouts felt a similar way.
But you never know if you're going to top it. I mean, that's the thing about baseball is that, you know, and you're going to see things that you haven't seen before. Look,
that's also very true.
I was at Veterans Stadium. You know, I've never been live for a no-hitter, but I was at Veterans Stadium and I saw Don Carmen, who is not what anyone would call a great pitcher historically. But Don Carmen threw a one-hitter, and the only hit he gave up was an infield hit by Mookie Wilson. And if you looked at the replay, Mookie Wilson was out. If he was in the replay back then, it would have been a no-hitter, and I would have been present for one of those. Every time you go to the ballpark, there's a real opportunity to see something that you haven't seen before, which is part of why – I mean, you go back to like, what do I love about baseball? Baseball is not standardized. The thing that I hate most are the humans, and one of them, unfortunately, is Commissioner of Baseball right now, who think the key to baseball is standardizing it. Let's eliminate the National League's lack of a designated hitter. Let's find ways to keep the minor leagues to 120 teams. You know, let's make sure that ballparks conform to, you know, there are people who complain about that. Oh, the ballparks are all different.
That's what makes it great. That's what's so cool about it.
Amazing about it. Why on earth we should? I love Taos Hill. I miss Taos Hill.
Right. It's, man.
You know, you got one of the great catches in baseball history because of Taos Hill, and your Carlos Beltran in the extra innings of a game between the Mets and Astros ran up the hill and made a catch.
And it's, you know, this kind of connects to the point with like the debate about robot umpires and instant replay and all these things. As I look at I was looking at Alex Bregman recently, actually, and his power numbers, and it's incredible how much he's been helped out by the left field dimensions in Houston. He outperformed he's outperformed his expected home runs, according to Statcast, by like 15 or 16.
Yes.
Over the last few years. And you look at him and it's all because he hits these high fly balls that just drop in the Crawford boxes, which we saw quite a bit of this past postseason. Between that and similar with close calls with umpires and instant replay, when you have guys getting called out because they had, you know, their cleat come off the bag for a fraction of a second sliding into second base. And people ask, well, do you want to get it right? And I'm kind of like, do you want every, I kind of like the human element. I like that you have those oddities where Alex Bregman probably does not come in third in MVP voting if he's playing in San Francisco in 2018. Maybe that sucks. Maybe you can hate that. I think it's kind of cool. You get both sides of it.
I've got two. So those are two different things I want to address in turn. Okay. Mm-hmm. So remind me about the umpire part. Okay. Because the Bregman thing. So I talked to, there's a woman named Eve Rosenbaum who works in the Baltimore Orioles minor league development system. And she was fantastic. She was a great source for a lot of different insights when it comes to the Baseball Talmud and as part of the new edition. And she pointed out the fact that, all right, we could say, you know, geez, it's the effect of Houston. But we gotta point to the fact that Alex Bregman understood he's playing for Houston, tailored his swing. He has altered his approach. So I'm not prepared to say at all, well, gee, you put him in a different ballpark. And Alex Bregman, who is, I mean, almost like comically hard work, if you go back and do his history. And it's like he was the 10-year-old who did two-a-day practices and then would go to the batting cages. Like, that was him. That's how he ended up in the major leagues. It's no mystery. Alex Bregman would have figured out how to hit anywhere, is my personal opinion. You know, that. To give you a historical comparison, people talked about Mel Ott, who hit something like
Polo Grounds, right?
30 of his 511 home runs at the Polo Grounds, right, in the short fence. And, you know, well, Mel Ott, if you put him somewhere else, well, Mel Ott was a damn good hitter and was a damn good hitter on the road, too. And we have no idea whether if you put Mel Ott in Yankee Stadium, if he would have had a different approach, or if you put Mel Ott in Sportsman's Park, if he would have had a different approach. There's chicken and egg here that I think we cannot just allow to overwhelm the way we view Alex Bregman specifically. So there's that, but to the umpire point, the drama of baseball and the fact that, you know, if it's a close play, you can't cheer yet because you got to wait 3 minutes or 5 minutes for a review. My honest belief about it is if there's something egregious and you can see it in 30 seconds, there's value to that to get it right. You're never going to get it 100% right. But what you are going to do is suck a lot of the life out of what is today entertainment. So 30 seconds. If there's something easily overturned in 30 seconds, great. Let's take advantage of replay. It's beyond 30 seconds. Let's move on with the game. And there's a human element to it.
Yeah, and to your point about Bregman, you're absolutely right. That's a great point. And I think that's actually, I work with the analytics and the new age stuff a lot. That's what most of my writing is based of. But I also, I like to think I have a very healthy skepticism of them, which, you know, is part of my liberal arts background, I guess, is just be skeptical of empiricism and all these other things. But
well, you know, do you know Jay Jaffe's line? Jay Jaffe described, and this was always felt perfect to me. Jay Jaffe described himself as part of the liberal arts wing of the sabermetrics community. That is where I consider myself to be. And there's nothing wrong with that, especially because there are very few people who are actually dogmatic on this in any real way. I wrote the Cardinals book. It was the same thing. It was this nonsense about, you know, the stat guys versus the scout guys. And actually, you did have a really interesting scouting conversation with the sabermetric guys, the quote-unquote sabermetric guys, and the scouting guys wanted to know the numbers. It's information. You know, everyone you know, pretends that that's even new in baseball. Like, the scouts versus stat guy, Branch Rickey invented the goddamn farm system, and Branch Rickey is the guy who employed the first sabermetric modern person way back in 1911 with the St. Louis Browns. He's the one who hired Alan Roth as a full-time statistician with the Brooklyn Dodgers. None of this is new. It's all what's been under the sun for the longest time. It is
so so much of this stuff is just is putting a name on things that we've always known.
Yeah.
Which is why I find a lot of these like heated debates that you see in these you know stupid internet spaces that just pretty funny. And what I was going to say though is to the point about Bregman, it makes me think of the debate about RBIs, where look, we know what the limitations of RBIs are. I am never going to go so far as to say that RBIs don't matter, because you look at a guy like Jose Abreu, who consistently puts up 100 ribbies every single year. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say that doesn't matter, or that's just a function of him being a number four hitter with guys on base in front of him. You know, it's not, he adjusts his approach. When he has a guy on third and less than two outs, he's going to hit it the other way. He's going to hit it in the air and get the guy in. These players, I think doesn't give, and this is not limited to just RBIs, this is kind of in general with these conversations that happen, I think it almost kind of by assigning a randomness to it, by taking it out of the hands of the players, almost kind of does a disservice to their skill in some ways.
It 100% does. This is a human game of action and reaction. But I would also say, just regarding RBI, right? We've got sharper tools to measure this. We don't have to sit there and be like, it's all about production, and we're just going to look at OPS plus, or we're just going to look at WRC plus, you know, whatever you want to do. We've got things like RBI percentage. You can go back and look, well, all right, Jose Abreu adjusts his approach. Jose Abreu is good at driving people in. How does he do relative to other similar power hitters? A guy with similar OPS plus numbers, does Jose, and I don't know this, I'm curious now. I'm going to go look after we're done.
Yeah, this is how you approach it. This is how you answer these questions.
Right.
Yeah.
When you say, you know, all right, there's a sharper tool. And is RBI an easier way to handle it? Is that a rough estimate? Fine, so be it. You know, we use those types of things all the time. And can we get a sharper look to be able to answer more specific questions? Yeah, damn right we can. And you can be sure that all over baseball, that's what they're doing as well. And there's nothing wrong with that. There are numbers that are now ingrained because our generation is used to them that were not a generation ago. 30 years from now, there are going to be numbers that are new and unfamiliar to us. And by the way, there are numbers that are already like that for me. And I can either sit here and take my fist at a cloud, or I could turn around and say, and I'll just use it as an example. We were driving yesterday as a family, and on Sunday, and exit velocity came up. And we're talking about that. And I'm talking to my wife about it. And my older daughter, Mirabelle, you know, we love it, because how cool is it to see that it comes off the bat? And my wife was like, but, you know, does it matter? And I said, that's kind of an open question. And as honestly, the question I need to know more about, you know, is it consistent exit velocity? Is it how consistently you're reaching a certain threshold? How predictive is that moving forward? I'm open to the idea that it is. I'm open to the idea that it's not. What I'm not going to do is throw my hands up in the air and say, oh, I'm just going to stick with RBI. Why would I do that? There's a chance to learn something new and interesting about the game I care about as much as anything outside of my family and friends. I'm going to want to know about it.
It's like a big puzzle that we're always manufacturing new pieces for, and sometimes they fit and sometimes they don't. But it's all about getting a slightly clearer picture of what you're seeing in front of you. And that's like, I just think that's so cool that we're consistently just adding more tools to be able to see, like, oh, like, I'm seeing something here and I'm wondering about it. I can go actually look it up. I can see whether I'm right or I'm wrong, whether, you know, if I'm wrong, there's something that I'm not seeing, and you can dig even further. And there's just so much to do with these tools that I find I don't quite understand the debates necessarily that are about, like, why do we have to kind of throw things out constantly? We can just, everything has some kind of purpose. You just have to know when to use things. Are RBIs appropriate most of the time? No, probably not. Does that mean we can't look at them and be like, oh, that guy did good things this year? Yeah, you know, there's a place for everything, in my opinion.
There's also the real enemy, which is, I think, and it extends beyond baseball. And the enemy is certainty. Mm-hmm. And that, and, you know, when I mentor a lot of young writers, and there are a lot of young writers I have who are absolutely sure of themselves being right about this. And, and somebody else isn't just of a different opinion, but are wrong. And you see it with older writers too. I'm not trying to make this about age, but the thing that I point out is, you know, so a recent thing I saw, without getting into the specifics of the criticisms, Whitey Herzog turned 90, and Rick Hummel, who's a Hall of Fame writer, interviewed him. Whitey Herzog's one of the sharpest people you're going to learn about baseball from. I've had the chance to interview him a couple of times. There were people who absolutely were convinced that what Whitey was saying was dead wrong on a host of different things. And maybe some of them were. And maybe some of them were right. But I'll be damned if I'm not going to listen to somebody who played baseball dating back to the 1960s, who managed some of the most interesting teams of our time. If he's talking about things that are wrong or right with baseball, ways that they can change, I just don't think we know. And a reason I'm certain we don't know is, is look at the minor league rule changes this year. They were put into place. People had theories about the way they might work, or not work. And those theories in many ways turned out to be totally unfounded. You know, there were ways in which I thought when they expanded the size of the bases, that we were going to see a massive increase in successful stolen bases. Almost nothing. Almost nothing. We just don't know. Again, in this endlessly complicated game with action and reaction, how we get there. And I'm old enough to remember when Theo Epstein was in his 20s fixing baseball. And Theo Epstein's job in Major League Baseball's front, you know, commissioner's office at this point is in many ways to fix the things he fixed back the other way.
Yeah, it gets, man. We got to have you back because I have, like, we could have a whole conversation about the philosophical side of entertainment versus winning at all costs and what that means. But we've got about 20 minutes before I want to let you go. So we have a whole host usually of non-baseball questions to move on. I'm just going to throw a few of them at you before we get to our final segment. And the first thing I have to ask is what we call the order of operations trifecta. And we're going to ask you about three things. And very simple, the order in which you do them. So the first of the order of operations trifecta is when you get dressed in the morning, socks versus pants, which one comes first?
See, you're asking a father of two. So, you know, I'll wake up, I'll have socks on already. I will, and especially this has happened over the last couple of years, I will switch from pajama pants to workout pants, knowing I'm going to work out after I drop my children off and get some work done. But socks versus pants, so I guess, you know, socks are the incumbent in that scenario. I'm showering after I work out later.
It's interesting. It started out, we're on episode, this is going to be, I'm not sure when over the next month we're going to release this exactly. This is going to be like 26 or 27. Okay. And it started out being people, it was mostly pants before socks people, and it's kind of switched the other way. And I enjoy seeing how people's fashion decisions and their order of operations are reflective of their lives sometimes.
It's important to note that fashion does not come into play here.
This is fair. Fashion is the wrong word.
It is triage between getting dressed and getting breakfast on the table to get my children to the school. That's the essence of it.
Yeah. So number two in the order of operations trifecta is if you eat cereal and if you drink milk and you have the two together, as most typically do, which comes first?
Oh, you put the cereal in and then you add the milk. It floats. Yeah. It's, you know, no, it disturbs the process. I hope that's been universal.
Close to universal. We actually asked that question because of one specific person who goes milk before cereal. Why? So in the works, his name is our guy Jake Seeley. He wrote a full article in theathletic.com, not only ranking his top 50 cereals, but explaining why he goes milk before cereal. Very, very controversial topic.
I'm in for new information, but it's hard to believe. In a way that, I don't want to dismiss RBI. I feel ready to dismiss that. But okay.
It's fair enough. Very fair. So the last part of the order of operations trifecta is when you brush your teeth, toothpaste or water first? What's the order?
Oh, water than toothpaste. I mean, that's a basic.
And then followed by water on top of the toothpaste? Once you're done?
No.
Straight in. Okay. Interesting. Does dry toothpaste on the wet brush?
Rinse the toothpaste?
Yeah, we usually go, I think the most common answer, which is what I do, is water, toothpaste, then water. Going dry with the toothpaste seems, I don't know, going in dry with the toothpaste seems like a lot. It's like kind of chalky.
It's liquid, you've got water underneath. Yeah, you put too much toothpaste on. I mean, my toothpaste lasts longer. You don't overdo the toothpaste, and then you've got it ready to go.
I think you're the second or third person maybe who has gone toothpaste with no water on top though. We've had one person who just goes straight toothpaste. We have one person who goes no water whatsoever. But that's a pretty rare response.
How dry is your mouth?
And not that dry. I just like to get the toothpaste when it is, especially you have a little bit that's touching the toothbrush, but most of the time, I don't know, it's not getting the water that's on the toothbrush isn't dampening the rest of it. I just find maybe it's just the consistency and texture of toothpaste going straight in onto the teeth. I don't know, with no further.
Maybe you need a toothpaste change of brand.
I don't know. I'm usually a Colgate guy, but it's interesting. I'm gonna have to bring this by Ben. I'm sure he would have some interesting things to say here.
I intend to listen and hear more.
Yes. Well, we're at some point. I'm gonna have to do a full supercut of all our answers here, just to. Show our guy Jake just how out there he is with his cereal. So moving on to the next question. I'm curious, if you could talk to any person in human history, it doesn't even have to be a specific person, it can be you can say someone who lived in South America in 1300, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Who would you talk to?
Any person?
Anybody.
How long do I have to talk to them?
Let's say you got an hour. You got an hour sit down.
An hour sit down. That's very hard. I mean, there are obviously some historical questions I'd very much like answered.
We've had usually with these questions, we find that sometimes the first answers that come to your head are often the best ones. We had someone say Tyler Glasnow earlier this year, which was a great answer. a lot of varieties. So whatever, no need to go super to think of something, super deep or profound if you don't feel like it.
But Abraham would be fascinating. Abraham. Though I am Jewish, I think we could resolve a lot of things that have happened since if I could get an hour with Jesus, to find out some things and maybe say, hey, watch for this,
That guy Judas, keep an eye out and side eye.
I'm saying, we could have converted. I don't know. That's a really good question. And then, I'd love to have had a conversation with Abraham Lincoln. I think would be interesting. If it's just purely it's not about getting answers, I just an hour talking to Dorothy Parker would be a lot of fun. Mm. That might be my answer. I might just, I'm not going to solve human history questions. So I'll just go see what Dorothy's up to, over at the Algonquin. Ideally, more than an hour, we could go see a George S. Kaufman play after we did.
Those are all fantastic answers, and I'm just cracking up at the thought of a 60-minute style interview with Abraham, and he's saying, "And when God told you to kill your son, how did you feel?"
I mean,
how did that make you feel?
Like, I've got nothing against Tyler Glass now, but I just don't know.
I love the full range of answers. Sometimes it's as simple as Tyler Glass now, and, you know, finding out how he gets those beautiful, beautiful locks taken care of. And Sometimes it's Abraham. So one more we get before we get to the final segment. This is one of our favorites. And it is okay if the answer is no. Have you ever seen a ghost or a UFO or something that you just could not explain?
Oh, well, so those are three very different things.
See, right? That's what I thought, too. That's just the way we have it worded on the thing. But okay. Like, you know, we're interested in the unexplained, I guess, writ large.
All right. So I have never seen a ghost, much to my chagrin. I would love to. That would be fantastic. I'm not willing to ignore the possibility that there is an afterlife, that there are people who are capable of coming back. But I've never seen any evidence of it, and so I don't currently believe it. The UFO thing, I was obsessed when I was a kid, and I loved reading about it. And it's very hard for me to believe in that case that there isn't life on other planets, you know, just given the sheer mathematics of it. But I haven't, ever seen that. But you know, I cannot to this day explain to you how Justin Turner turned into the star he became after he left the Mets. And so if you're asking me what about those unexplained, I think that's an easy answer. And I love Justin Turner. And the Mets were wrong to non-tender him because he was a very valuable utility infielder. But no one – I remember talking in spring of 2013. I went out to do a story in spring of 2014 at a Camelback Ranch. And, you know, he was clearly – but he was on the border whether he was going to make the Dodgers or not. Mm-hmm. He ended up getting one of their last roster spots. And then he turned into a star for the decade. And it's unexplained.
I can't remember the name of his coach who's worked. I think he worked with – I could be mixing people up, but I think he worked with the same guy who – overhauled Mookie Betts' swing the year before he won his MVP award. Yeah, because he was an early adopter of the fly ball revolution, so to speak. Right. You know, buying into launch angle and all that stuff. So that is a very funny answer.
However, and just to go full circle on that, the Mets replaced him with Eric Campbell, who had tremendous exit velocity, but hit more ground balls than just about anybody, making that exit velocity essentially worthless.
Yeah. So we've got about 10 minutes left before I have to let you go and you got to get your kids. So we'll squeeze this last segment in here and it's called the full count.
Okay.
It's called the full count because 3 and 2 is 5. We ask you for recommendations in 5 different categories.
Oh, I love it.
And it's usually, like I said, usually the first thing that comes to mind doesn't have to be anything super profound.
Mm-hmm.
And so our first question is recommend us a book. And like I said, it doesn't have to be like, you know, Moby Dick or something like that. We've had comic books in the past, you know, whatever strikes your fancy.
I'm going to give you everything that Katherine Heine has ever written.
I'm not familiar.
A wonderful young novelist. Her newest is Early Morning Riser, and it's great. But just Standard Deviation, Single Carefree Mellow. One of them is a novel. Another is a book of stories. Katherine Heine is wonderful. Lily King is wonderful. I'm going to go Katherine Heine.
Okay, word. I'm gonna have to look her up. I'm not familiar. So recommendation. I link usually when I put stuff in the notes. I link to all the sources and stuff like that. So hopefully people will check that out. And I try to make a point to check out everything as well. Oh, so.
She's fantastic. She's so good.
Good. So number 2 is a food recommendation, which could be like restaurant, ingredient, meal, dish, you know, whatever, anything food related.
If you are in the Philadelphia area, and specifically on the South Jersey side, South Jersey pretzel and water ice, get the soft pretzels. I'm going to go visit my parents for Thanksgiving in a couple of weeks. I'm going to do that. They are the best pretzels I've ever eaten. It's not close.
Interesting. That's another thing. I don't think you don't have pretzels in the Midwest in the way you have joints out east. It's similar to the bagel situation I've found.
It is. It is I'm sorry for you. It is we are all going to drown because of global warming. But before we do, we're going to have better bagels and pretzels. And so, you know, again, if you don't have those, is it living? I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, I will find myself in South Jersey sooner or later. I mean, I haven't spent much time in the Philadelphia area, but I know quite a few folks who are out there. So I'm going to keep that one in mind for sure. So recommendation number three, which is technically two, but it can only be one if you want, is movies and or TV.
My favorite movie of all time is The Third Man. Orson Welles is not the director, but he plays a wonderful role within it. I think it's the best film ever made. I also love To Be or Not To Be, the original, the Ernst Lubitsch version, with Jack Benny and Carol Lombard shortly before she tragically died in a plane crash. It depends if you want lighter. You go with To Be or Not To Be if you want a little more serious, but not too heavy. The Third Man, those are both fantastic. Oh, and Philadelphia Story, if you want to go really light, with the only time that Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart were in the same movie together somehow.
Ha! My grandma was huge fans of both of them. She could, I'm sure she'd have a lot to say of that. You've been watching any TV lately? Anything you'd recommend?
I mean, you know, the new season of Curb Your Enthusiasm is here, and I love every minute of it. Obviously, The Good Place is one of the best shows I've seen in recent years, and something I love. Dead to Me is a show that I really enjoyed several seasons with Christina Applegate, that is terrific as well. And listen, if you're in the mood for a miniseries, a very English Scandal with Hugh Grant was particularly notably good.
Word. Thank you for those. Those are all. Once Succession is over this year, I'm gonna have to find something else to watch. Watch once or twice a week. So,
all recommended.
Mm-hmm. So recommendation number four. We often talk about music on this pod a lot because Ben is a huge music guy. Mm-hmm. We didn't get to that much today. So, can you give me a music recommendation?
Bria Stoneberg, a wonderful jazz trumpet/vocalist, really, really good. Several albums, Jersey product. Can't go wrong with Bria Stoneberg. Veronica Swift, I had the chance to see in person, and she is one of the best young jazz vocalists working today. She has a new album out called This Bitter Earth. It was nominated for a Grammy. It's terrific, and I'm just going to round out the trio with Emmett Cohen, Pride of Montclair, New Jersey. He is a jazz pianist. He's gotten big. A few years ago, I had a chance to see him at a local venue called Shanghai Jazz, which is, by the way, a combination music and food recommendation. It is a Chinese restaurant that has great jazz music.
Oh, that's so cool.
It's so cool. John Picciarelli appears there, Calvin Russell. If you don't know John Picciarelli, by the way, learn John Picciarelli because he's the best jazz vocalist working today. And so I was there, and Emmett Cohen's drummer was 45 minutes late, and we had the seat next to the piano. Mirabelle, my older daughter, and I were sitting there. She was about 7 or 8 at the time. And we just got to know Emmett Cohen, just this really nice young man who is a fantastic jazz pianist. Absolutely love him.
That's awesome. That's definitely the first jazz recommendation we've gotten so far. I am on record as thinking that one of the most live jazz and good food in combination, like out to dinner at a nice jazz joint, is one of the most at least for maybe for my generation, for folks who are not super generally familiar with jazz, one of the most underrated things out there, things you can do. It's always a great way to spend an evening.
If I could pick the thing I've missed the most, and we still aren't eating inside, now that the girls are vaccinated,
a different
conclusion. Oh,
we're almost there.
Can you hear me?
Yep. You are back now. I lost you for a sec.
Oh, good. And I'm sorry there's a glare, by the way.
No, it's fine.
I'm trying to block it with my head. from my perspective, we haven't been eating inside. We may, now that the girls are vaccinated, but, you know, we're like everyone else trying to figure it out.
I haven't really been doing much of that.
That's what I've missed the most, you know, is going to a jazz club where everyone's on top of each other, which sounds bad from a COVID perspective, but from a living perspective, wonderful.
So you're right there, and within small tables, and the
singer is right there in front of you, and the trio is there, and I got to get back to Birdland very soon.
Oh yeah, man! I wanna try that. Check this combination Chinese food jazz night sounds amazing. Almost kind of fits with the final recommendation of the full count is miscellaneous. Can be literally anything at all. Object, practice, whatever.
I'm going to give you a very old person's recommendation, even though I'm only 41. Flannel pants for over the last couple of years, I was never a pajama person. I found soft flannel pants to wear in the evening. It gives me a feeling, even on a day that is not so formal, and you know, you're able to see the video. I'm obviously not in formal attire. I don't have a top hat at the moment. But when I change to relax, it gives me a sense of a break of finality with the day. Soft flannel pajama.
I love that, especially. I'm also fully work from home. I'm in this room for freaking 75% of the day, you know. But so I'm still. You saw when I went up to get that mouse. I'm currently in pajama pants. I spend much of my day in pajama pants these days. So that's. I'm fully on board with that recommendation. Wow, it is 1:30 Eastern on the dot. We wrapped this up perfectly, so you can go get your kids for school. Howard. It has been such a pleasure. I was really looking forward to this conversation, and I just had a lot of fun. So thank you so, so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, and glad we can make it happen, and hope we get to do it again.
Absolutely. I mean, sooner or later, we have to start bringing guests around for 2.0, because there's so much we love talking about, and we can never fit it all into an hour to 2 minutes, hour and a half.